When his servants told him that there was a poor peasant girl named Joan of Arc, accompanied by nobody but an old village wheelwright and cartmaker, who wished to see him because she was commanded to help the Dauphin and save France, Baudricourt burst out a-laughing, and bade them send the girl away. But, he soon heard so much about her lingering in the town, and praying in the churches, and seeing visions, and doing harm to no one, that he sent for her, and questioned her. As she said the same things after she had been well sprinkled with holy water, as she had said before the sprinkling, Baudricourt began to think there might be something in it. At all events, he thought it worthwhile to send her on to the town of Chinon, where the Dauphin was. So, he bought her a horse, and a sword, and gave her two squires to conduct her. As the voices had told Joan that she was to wear a Marnetier-mess dress, now, she put one on, and girded her sword to her side, and bound spurs to her heels, and mounted her horse and rode away with her two squires. As to her uncle the wheelwright, he stood staring at his niece in wonder until she was out of sight, as well he might, and then went home again. The best place, too. Joan and her two squires rode on and on, until they came to Chinon, where she was, after some doubt, admitted into the Dauphinetier's presence. Picking him out immediately from all his court, she told him that she came commanded by heaven to subdue his enemies and conduct him to his coronation at Reims. She also told him, or he pretended so afterwards, to make the greater impression upon his soldiers, a number of his secrets known only to himself, and, furthermore, she said there was an old sword in the Cathedral of St. Catherine at Fyboys, marked with five old crosses on the blade, which St. Catherine had ordered her to wear. Now, nobody knew anything about this old sword, but when the cathedral came to be examined, the witch was immediately near there. Sure enough, the sword was found. The Dauphin then required a number of grave priests and bishops to give him their opinion whether the girl derived her power from good spirits or from evil spirits, which they held prodigiously long debates about, in the course of which several learned men fell fast asleep and snored loudly. At last, when one gruff old gentleman had said to Joan, "What language do your voices speak?" And when Joan had replied to the gruff old gentleman, "A pleasanter language than yours," they agreed that it was all correct, and that Joan of Arc was inspired from heaven. This wonderful circumstance put new heart into the Dauphinetier's soldiers when they heard of it, and dispirited the English army, who took Joan for a witch. So Joan mounted horse again, and again rode on and on, until she came to Orleans. But she rode now, as never peasant girl had ridden yet. She rode upon a white war horse, in a suit of glittering armor, with the old sword from the cathedral, newly burnished, in her belt, with a white flag carried before her, upon which were a picture of God, and the words Jesus Maria. In this splendid state, at the head of a great body of troops escorting provisions of all kinds for the starving inhabitants of Orleans, she appeared before that beleaguered city. When the people on the walls beheld her, they cried out, "Ah, the maid is come! The maid of the prophecy is come to deliver us!" And this, and the sight of the maid fighting at the head of their men, made the French so bold, and made the English so fearful, that the English line of forts was soon broken, the troops and provisions were got into the town, and Orleans was saved. Joan, henceforth called the Maid of Orleans, remained within the walls for a few days, and caused letters to be thrown over, ordering Lord Suffolk and his Englishmen to depart from before the town according to the will of heaven. As the English general very positively declined to believe that Joan knew anything about the will of heaven, which did not mend the matter with his soldiers, for they stupidly said if she were not inspired she was a witch, and it was of no use to fight against a witch, she mounted her white war horse again, and ordered her white banner to advance. The besiegers held the bridge, and some strong towers upon the bridge, and here the Maid of Orleans attacked them. The fight was 14 hours long. She planted a scaling ladder with her own hands, and mounted a tower wall, but was struck by an English arrow in the neck, and fell into the trench. She was carried away and the arrow was taken out, during which operation she screamed and cried with the pain, as any other girl might have done, but presently she said that the voices were speaking to her and soothing her to rest. After a while, she got up, and was again foremost in the fight. When the English who had seen her fall and supposed her dead, saw this, they were troubled with the strangest fears, and some of them cried out that they beheld St. Michael on a white horse, probably Joan herself, fighting for the French. They lost the bridge, and lost the towers, and next day set their chain of forts on fire, and left the place. But as Lord Suffolk himself retired no farther than the town of Jarge, which was only a few miles off, the Maid of Orleans besieged him there, and he was taken prisoner. As the white banner scaled the wall, she was struck upon the head with a stone, and was again tumbled down into the ditch, but, she only cried all the more, as she lay there, "Eon, on, my countrymen, and fear nothing, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hands." ATM After this new success of the Maid of TMS, several other fortresses and places which had previously held out against the Dauphin were delivered up without a battle, and at Patay she defeated the remainder of the English army, and set up her victorious white banner on a field where 1,200 Englishmen lay dead. She now urged the Dauphin, who always kept out of the way when there was any fighting, to proceed to Reims, as the first part of her mission was accomplished, and to complete the whole by being crowned there. The Dauphin was in no particular hurry to do this, as Reims was a long way off, and the English and the Duke of Burgundy were still strong in the country through which the road lay. However, they set forth, with 10,000 men, and again the Maid of Orleans rode on and on, upon her white war horse, and in her shining armor. Whenever they came to a town which yielded readily, the soldiers believed in her, but, whenever they came to a town which gave them any trouble, they began to murmur that she was an impostor. The latter was particularly the case at Troyes, which finally yielded, however, through the persuasion of one Richard, a friar of the place. Friar Richard was in the old doubt about the Maid of Orleans, until he had sprinkled her well with holy water, and had also well sprinkled the threshold of the gate by which she came into the city. Finding that it made no change in her or the gate, he said, as the other grave old gentleman had said, that it was all right, and became her great ally. So, at last, by dint of riding on, the Maid of Orleans, and the Dauphin, and the 10,000 sometimes believing and sometimes unbelieving men, came to Reims. And in the great cathedral of Reims, the Dauphin actually was crowned Charles VII in a great assembly of the people. Then, the Maid, who with her white banner stood beside the king in the tower of his triumph, kneeled down upon the pavement at his feet, and said, with tears, that what she had been inspired to do, was done, and that the only recompense she asked for, was, that she should now have leave to go back to her distant home, and her sturdily incredulous father, and her first simple escort the village wheelwright and cartmaker. But the king said no. ATM and made her and her family as noble as a king could, and settled upon her the income of a count. Ah! Happy had it been for the Maid of Orleans, if she had resumed her rustic dress that day, and had gone home to the little chapel and the wild hills, and had forgotten all these things, and had been a good Marnetiam's wife, and had heard no stranger voices than the voices of little children. It was not to be, and she continued helping the king. She did a world for him, in alliance with Friar Richard, and trying to improve the lives of the coarse soldiers, and leading a religious, an unselfish, and a modest life, herself, beyond any doubt. Still, many times she prayed the king to let her go home, and once she even took off her bright armor and hung it up in a church, meaning never to wear it more. But the king always won her back again while she was of any use to him, and so she went on, to her doom. When the Duke of Bedford, who was a very able man, began to be active for England, and, by bringing the war back into France and by holding the Duke of Burgundy to his faith, to distress and disturb Charles very much, Charles sometimes asked the Maid of Orleans what the voices said about it. But, the voices had become very like ordinary voices in perplexed times, contradictory and confused, so that now they said one thing, and now said another, and the maid lost credit every day. Charles marched on Paris, which was opposed to him, and attacked the suburb of Saint Honoré tilde copyright. In this fight, being again struck down into the ditch, she was abandoned by the whole army. She lay unaided among a heap of dead, and crawled out how she could. Then, some of her believers went over to an opposition maid, Catherine of La Rochelle, who said she was inspired to tell where there were treasures of buried money though she never did, and then Joan accidentally broke the old sword, and others said that her power was broken with it. Finally, at the siege of Compiègne tilde d'Arcisson, held by the Duke of Burgundy, where she did valiant service, she was basely left alone in a retreat, though facing about and fighting to the last, and an archer pulled her off her horse. Oh, the uproar that was made, and the thanksgivings that were sung, about the capture of this one poor country girl. Oh, the way in which she was demanded to be tried for sorcery and heresy, and anything else you like, by the Inquisitor General of France, and by this great man, and by that great man, until it is wearisome to think of. She was bought at last by the Bishop of Vise for 10,000 francs, and was shut up in her narrow prison, plain Joan of Arc again, and Maid of Orleans no more. I should never have done if I were to tell you how they had Joan out to examine her, and cross-examine her, and re-examine her, and worry her into saying anything and everything, and how all sorts of scholars and doctors bestowed their utmost tediousness upon her. 16 times she was brought out and shut up again, and worried, and entrapped, and argued with, until she was heart-sick of the dreary business. On the last occasion of this kind she was brought into a burial place at Rouen, dismally decorated with a scaffold, and a stake and faggots, and the executioner, and a pulpit with a friar therein, and an awful sermon ready. It is very affecting to know that even at that pass the poor girl honored the mean vermin of a king, who had so used her for his purposes and so abandoned her, and, that while she had been regardless of reproaches heaped upon herself, she spoke out courageously for him. It was natural in one so young to hold to life. To save her life, she signed a declaration prepared for her, signed it with a cross, for she cognitiamt writer that all her visions and voices had come from the devil. Upon her recanting the past, and protesting that she would never wear a manutiamus dress in future, she was condemned to imprisonment for life, on the bread of sorrow and the water of affliction. ATM. But, on the bread of sorrow and the water of affliction, the visions and the voices soon returned. It was quite natural that they should do so, for that kind of disease is much aggravated by fasting, loneliness, and anxiety of mind. It was not only got out of Joan that she considered herself inspired again, but, she was taken in a manutiamus dress, which had been left her to entrap Hera in her prison, and which she put on, in her solitude, perhaps, in remembrance of her past glories, perhaps, because the imaginary voices told her. For this relapse into the sorcery and heresy and anything else you like, she was sentenced to be burnt to death. And, in the marketplace of Rouen, in the hideous dress which the monks had invented for such spectacles, with priests and bishops sitting in a gallery looking on, though some had the Christian grace to go away, unable to endure the infamous scene, this shrieking girl a last seen amidst the smoke and fire, holding a crucifix between her hands, last heard, calling upon Christ, so was burnt to ashes. They threw her ashes into the river Seine, but they will rise against her murderers on the last day. From the moment of her capture, neither the French king nor one single man in all his court raised a finger to save her. It is no defense of them that they may have never really believed in her, or that they may have won her victories by their skill and bravery. The more they pretended to believe in her, the more they had caused her to believe in herself, and she had ever been true to them, ever brave, ever nobly devoted. But, it is no wonder, that they, who were in all things false to themselves, false to one another, false to their country, false to heaven, false to earth, should be monsters of ingratitude and treachery to a helpless peasant girl. In the picturesque old town of Rouen, where weeds and grass grow high on the cathedral towers, and the venerable Norman streets are still warm in the blessed sunlight, though the monkish fires that once gleamed horribly upon them have long grown cold, there is a statue of Joan of Arc, in the scene of her last agony, the square to which she has given its present name. I know some statues of modern times are even in the world at TMS Metropolis, I think a which commemorate less constancy, less earnestness, smaller claims upon the world at TMS attention, and much greater impostors. Part the third, bad deeds seldom prosper, happily for mankind, and the English cause gained no advantage from the cruel death of Joan of Arc. For a long time, the war went heavily on. The Duke of Bedford died, the alliance with the Duke of Burgundy was broken, and Lord Talbot became a great general on the English side in France. But, two of the consequences of wars are, famine because the people cannot peacefully cultivate the ground and pestilence, which comes of want, misery, and suffering. Both these horrors broke out in both countries, and lasted for 2 wretched years. Then, the war went on again, and came by slow degrees to be so badly conducted by the English government, that, within 20 years from the execution of the Maid of Orleans, of all the great French conquests, the town of Calais alone remained in English hands. While these victories and defeats were taking place in the course of time, many strange things happened at home. The young king, as he grew up, proved to be very unlike his great father, and showed himself a miserable puny creature. There was no harm in him, he had a great aversion to shedding blood, which was something but, he was a weak, silly, helpless young man, and a mere shuttlecock to the great lordly battledores about the court. Of these battledores, Cardinal Beaufort, a relation of the king, and the Duke of Gloucester, were at first the most powerful. The Duke of Gloucester had a wife, who was nonsensically accused of practicing witchcraft to cause the king a TMS death and lead to her husband a TMS coming to the throne, he being the next heir. She was charged with having, by the help of a ridiculous old woman named Marjorie, who was called a witch, made a little waxen doll in the king of TMS likeness, and put it before a slow fire that it might gradually melt away. It was supposed, in such cases, that the death of the person whom the doll was made to represent, was sure to happen. Whether the Duchess was as ignorant as the rest of them, and really did make such a doll with such an intention, I don't yet know, but, you and I know very well that she might have made 1,000 dolls, if she had been stupid enough, and might have melted them all, without hurting the king or anybody else. However, she was tried for it, and so was old Marjorie. And so was one of the Duke of TMS chaplains, who was charged with having assisted them. Both he and Marjorie were put to death, and the Duchess, after being taken on foot and bearing a lighted candle, 3 times round the city, as a penance, was imprisoned for life. The Duke, himself, took all this pretty quietly, and made as little stir about the matter as if he were rather glad to be rid of the Duchess. But, he was not destined to keep himself out of trouble long. The royal shuttlecock being 23, the battledores were very anxious to get him married. The Duke of Gloucester wanted him to marry a daughter of the Count of Armagnac, but, the Cardinal and the Earl of Suffolk were all for Margaret, the daughter of the King of Sicily, who they knew was a resolute, ambitious woman and would govern the king as she chose. To make friends with this lady, the Earl of Suffolk, who went over to arrange the match, consented to accept her for the King of TMS wife without any fortune, and even to give up the 2 most valuable possessions England then had in France. So, the marriage was arranged, on terms very advantageous to the lady, and Lord Suffolk brought her to England, and she was married at Westminster. On what pretense this queen and her party charged the Duke of Gloucester with high treason within a couple of years, it is impossible to make out, the matter is so confused, but, they pretended that the King of TMS life was in danger, and they took the Duke prisoner. A fortnight afterwards, he was found dead in bed, they said, and his body was shown to the people, and Lord Suffolk came in for the best part of his estates. You know by this time how strangely liable state prisoners were to sudden death. If Cardinal Beaufort had any hand in this matter, it did him no good, for he died within 6 weeks, thinking it very hard and curious at 80 years old. A. That he could not live to be Pope. This was the time when England had completed her loss of all her great French conquests. The people charged the loss principally upon the Earl of Suffolk, now Duke, who had made those easy terms about the royal marriage, and who, they believed, had even been bought by France. So he was impeached as a traitor, on a great number of charges, but chiefly on accusations of having aided the French king, and of designing to make his own son King of England. The commons and the people being violent against him, the king was made, by his friends, to interpose to save him, by banishing him for 5 years, and proroguing the Parliament. The Duke had much ado to escape from a London mob, 2,000 strong, who lay in wait for him in street gallows at EMS Fields, but, he got down to his own estates in Suffolk, and sailed away from Ipswich. Sailing across the Channel, he sent into Calais to know if he might land there, but, they kept his boat and men in the harbour, until an English ship, carrying 150 men and called the Nicholas of the Tower, came alongside his little vessel, and ordered him on board. A welcome, traitor, as men say. ATM was the captain at EMS Grimmond's not very respectful salutation. He was kept on board, a prisoner, for 8 and 40 hours, and then a small boat appeared rowing toward the ship. As this boat came nearer, it was seen to have in it a block, a rusty sword, and an executioner in a black mask. The Duke was handed down into it, and there his head was cut off with 6 strokes of the rusty sword. Then, the little boat rowed away to Dover Beach, where the body was cast out, and left until the Duchess claimed it. By whom, high in authority, this murder was committed, has never appeared. No one was ever punished for it. The now rose in Kent an Irishman, who gave himself the name of Mortimer, but whose real name was Jack Cade. Jack, in imitation of Wat Tyler, though he was a very different and inferior sort of man, addressed the Kentish men upon their wrongs, occasioned by the bad government of England, among so many battledores and such a poor shuttlecock, and the Kentish men rose up to the number of 20,000. Their place of assembly was Blackheath, where, headed by Jack, they put forth 2 papers, which they called Other Complaint of the Commons of Kent, ATM and Other Requests of the Captain of the Great Assembly in Kent. ATM they then retired to Seville Oaks. The royal army coming up with them here, they beat it and killed their general. Then, Jack dressed himself in the dead general at EMS armor, and led his men to London. Jack passed into the city from Southwark, over the bridge, and entered it in triumph, giving the strictest orders to his men not to plunder. Having made a show of his forces there, while the citizens looked on quietly, he went back into Southwark in good order, and passed the night. Next day, he came back again, having got hold in the meantime of Lord Say, an unpopular nobleman. Says Jack to the Lord Mayor and judges, A. Will you be so good as to make a tribunal in Guildhall, and try me this nobleman? ATM the court being hastily made, he was found guilty, and Jack and his men cut his head off on Cornhill. They also cut off the head of his son-in-law, and then went back in good order to Southwark again. But, although the citizens could bear the beheading of an unpopular lord, they could not bear to have their houses pillaged. And it did so happen that Jack, after dinner perhaps he had drunk a little too much, began to plunder the house where he lodged, upon which, of course, his men began to imitate him. Wherefore, the Londoners took counsel with Lord Scales, who had 1,000 soldiers in the Tower, and defended London Bridge, and kept Jack and his people out. This advantage gained, it was resolved by divers great men to divide Jack at EMS army in the old way, by making a great many promises on behalf of the state, that were never intended to be performed. This did divide them, some of Jack at EMS men saying that they ought to take the conditions which were offered, and others saying that they ought not, for they were only a snare, some going home at once, others staying where they were, and all doubting and quarrelling among themselves. Jack, who was in 2 minds about fighting or accepting a pardon, and who indeed did both, saw at last that there was nothing to expect from his men, and that it was very likely some of them would deliver him up and get a reward of 1,000 marks, which was offered for his apprehension. So, after they had travelled and quarrelled all the way from Southwark to Blackheath, and from Blackheath to Rochester, he mounted a good horse and galloped away into Sussex. But, there galloped after him, on a better horse, one Alexander Iden, who came up with him, had a hard fight with him, and killed him. Jack at TMS Head was set aloft on London Bridge, with the face looking towards Blackheath, where he had raised his flag, and Alexander Iden got the 1,000 marks. It is supposed by some, that the Duke of York, who had been removed from a high post abroad through the Queen at TMS influence, and sent out of the way, to govern Ireland, was at the bottom of this rising of Jack and his men, because he wanted to trouble the government. He claimed, though not yet publicly, to have a better right to the throne than Henry of Lancaster, as one of the family of the Earl of March, whom Henry IV had set aside. Touching this claim, which, being through female relationship, was not according to the usual descent, it is enough to say that Henry IV was the free choice of the people and the Parliament, and that his family had now reigned undisputed for 60 years. The memory of Henry V was so famous, and the English people loved it so much, that the Duke of York at TMS claim would, perhaps, never have been thought of. It would have been so hopeless, but for the unfortunate circumstance of the present King at TMS being by this time quite an idiot, and the country very ill-governed. These two circumstances gave the Duke of York a power he could not otherwise have had, whether the Duke knew anything of Jack Cade, or not. He came over from Ireland while Jack at TMS Head was on London Bridge, being secretly advised that the Queen was setting up his enemy, the Duke of Somerset, against him. He went to Westminster, at the head of 4,000 men, and on his knees before the King, represented to him the bad state of the country, and petitioned him to summon a Parliament to consider it. This the King promised. When the Parliament was summoned, the Duke of York accused the Duke of Somerset, and the Duke of Somerset accused the Duke of York, and, both in and out of Parliament, the followers of each party were full of violence and hatred towards the other. At length the Duke of York put himself at the head of a large force of his tenants, and, in arms, demanded the reformation of the government. Being shut out of London, he encamped at Dartford, and the royal army encamped at Blackheath. According as either side triumphed, the Duke of York was arrested, or the Duke of Somerset was arrested. The trouble ended, for the moment, in the Duke of York renewing his oath of allegiance, and going in peace to one of his own castles. Half a year afterwards the Queen gave birth to a son, who was very ill received by the people, and not believed to be the son of the King. It shows the Duke of York to have been a moderate man, unwilling to involve England in new troubles, that he did not take advantage of the general discontent at this time, but really acted for the public good. He was made a member of the cabinet, and the King being now so much worse that he could not be carried about and shown to the people with any decency, the Duke was made Lord Protector of the kingdom, until the King should recover, or the Prince should come of age. At the same time the Duke of Somerset was committed to the Tower. So, now the Duke of Somerset was down, and the Duke of York was up. By the end of the year, however, the King recovered his memory and some spark of sense, upon which the Queen used her power which recovered with Hema to get the Protector disgraced, and her favourite released. So now the Duke of York was down, and the Duke of Somerset was up. These dual ups and downs gradually separated the whole nation into the two parties of York and Lancaster, and led to those terrible civil wars long known as the Wars of the Red and White Roses, because the Red Rose was the badge of the House of Lancaster, and the White Rose was the badge of the House of York. The Duke of York, joined by some other powerful noblemen of the White Rose party, and leading a small army, met the King with another small army at St. Alban at TMS, and demanded that the Duke of Somerset should be given up. The poor King, being made to say in answer that he would sooner die, was instantly attacked. The Duke of Somerset was killed, and the King himself was wounded in the neck, and took refuge in the house of a poor tanner. Whereupon, The Duke of York went to him, led him with great submission to the abbey, and said he was very sorry for what had happened. Having now the king in his possession, he got a parliament summoned and himself once more made protector. But, only for a few months, for, on the king getting a little better again, the queen and her party got him into their possession, and disgraced the duke once more. So, now the Duke of York was down again,